This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to our newest episode of the Neuro Innovation Talks podcast. I'm here with our great host, John Murray of J&J Neurovascular. John, you got another great episode here. This is a great conversation. I think people are really going to enjoy it.
Yeah, I enjoyed the discussion with Chuck Kerber. What an amazing individual. So thanks so much.
He's Chuck Kerber. He's an emeritus professor of radiology and neurosurgery at UCSD. And as we were talking before we pushed record, he's got one of those voices you just can't get enough. It's like potato chips. You want to keep listening and getting another piece of wisdom. So it's clear why you picked him to be part of this this series. What were some of the takeaways from your conversation with Dr. Kerber?
Yeah, as you know, thanks, Tom. We were really thoughtful about which physicians we wanted to feature in this podcast, and Chuck Kerber certainly fits that bill. Mm-hmm. He was part of this early formation of the neurovascular field where we expanded the boundaries of what was possible in neurovascular. He's a pioneer and a maverick, quite frankly. And you're right. It was a conversation. I really enjoyed spending time talking with him. But I wanted to make sure that when we spoke with him that we uncovered some of his amazing medical innovations. He was involved in developing flow-directed catheters, calibrated leak balloon, and of course, his role in bringing NBCA to the forefront of neurovascular was really one of the things he's most famous for. But we also spent a lot of time talking about his life and the values that he carries from his childhood, because that weaves into everything that he did as a mentor. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, the word that came up most about Chuck Kerber when we spoke to his mentees, his colleagues, was gentleman. Yep. And I think it really relates to his kindness, humility, and modesty. He was a U.S. Marine. He spent a lot of time building a career based on putting the patient first and training other physicians. So I think a lot of this amazing information will shine through in our discussion on the podcast today.
Yeah, he was very exacting about that, about the responsibility of surgeons. But, and I could speak personally, just I enjoyed hearing his story, but also as someone who just tries to innovate and create in the podcast and content, just his approach to innovation and to being open to ideas and just sort of allowing them to come to you. I think it was just great advice for anyone who wants to find better ways of doing things. I think it's a lot of valuable lessons here for sure.
I agree. And he has a message for the young physicians at the very end. So I think people will want to stay tuned.
I think I know the one you're talking about. So without any delay, let's begin the conversation you had with Dr. Charles Chuck Kerber, Emeritus Professor of Radiology and Neurosurgery at UCSD. But before we begin that conversation, I want to introduce a conversation our managing editor, Kayleen Brown, had with our sponsor, Resonetics.
Andy, welcome to the podcast. Really appreciate you taking your time with us today. I want to start by talking about your current role at Resonetics and the current location and site that you're at.
I'm Andy Paganaw. I'm the Director of Strategic Projects in Bethel, Connecticut. I was part of the acquisition of Memory Corporation late last year, and I'm on the Lightspeed team.
Oh, so the Lightspeed team, that can you go into more detail? What is Lightspeed Lab? What do you do?
Lightspeed is the new product development group within Resonetics. We have dedicated resources that allow us to move really quickly. And we have really aggressive goals on quote turnaround time and prototype lead times. We're actually just setting up a new Lightspeed Lab here in Bethel, Connecticut.
So if you're setting up a new lab in Bethel, Connecticut, what is your specific specialty and the specialty of the lab?
So coming from the legacy Memory Corporation site, from the acquisition, we're really focused on nitinol materials and nitinol medical devices. We will do everything from laser cutting, shape setting, through to conventional machining and surface finishing of nitinol components. But our specific focus in Bethel is really going to be on orthopedic implants, surgical tools, and things like that.
Well, congratulations about your new site. Can you take us through the different orthopedic applications that you work on?
Yeah, I mean, we work on tons of different applications. A lot of them are focused on extremities. So looking at bone staples, compression plates, hammer toe implants for foot and ankle, K-wires, surgical drills. And we also do a lot of things like suture anchor inserters for suture pass and suture passing wires. You know, the suture passer is actually one of the first FDA cleared nitinol implant devices. So it's been around for a while. And in Bethel, Connecticut here, we've been manufacturing those since the beginning. And these applications are rapidly expanding to other applications, for example, spine. You know, and our customers are really seeking to utilize the unique functional properties of the nitinol material that we work with.
You have experience with nitinol very clearly since the very beginning. How do you help companies get to market faster and improve the quality of their device?
Definitely expertise and experience. So you hit that nail on the head there. You know, we've been making bone staples, for example, for over 10 years. Suture passers and drills, we've been making for over 15 years. So we really have a good understanding of, you know, the process flows. We have optimized processes for all these different types of devices. We also have a fully equipped test lab. So for helping with some regulatory submissions, we do corrosion testing, mechanical testing, and we have the ability to measure phase transformations. In upstate New York, we have our Resonetics Smart Materials site, which is one of the first commercial melters of nitinol. So we actually have the added advantage as well, looking all the way back to the starting material and what net shape, if it is a unique net shape, unique properties that we need to start with, we have that advantage as well.
Well, that's great. We'll hear a little more from Resonetics later on in the podcast episode. If you want to find out more information about Resonetics right now, go to its website, resonetics.com.
So here we are in the podcast with Dr. Charles Kerber. Dr. Kerber, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. I appreciate being here.
I would have preferred if you would call me John.
Yeah, well, you know, it goes both ways. I mean, we've known each other 100 years.
That's
first
right.
Names, please.
Thank you. And I will say for our listeners, Chuck and I had an opportunity last week to sit down in San Diego and have a quick chat. So I'm really excited about the opportunity to dive into some of the questions that I have for Chuck. Let's start with what I think is really critical here. Chuck, you're certainly considered a pioneer in the neurovascular field, but this field literally did not exist when you started your career as a physician. What is it that drove you to commit your energy and resources to addressing these unmet needs in neurovascular disease?
We didn't know there were unmet needs. That's number one. We just kind of got interested in things and it progressed. So for me, I think I've always been interested in the brain, even as a kid. And then I can remember an afternoon, first year medical school, going into neuro lab and being able to hold a human brain in my hand. And I was in awe of that. That's what makes us what we are. So it was kind of inevitable that I would travel down that pathway. Second, luck. I had a lot of luck. I mean, I was fortuitously in the right place at the right time. I will admit that some of that luck was really bad luck, but nonetheless, good luck by and large. So how to do things? Well, it most of these things are going to go back to my family. We were not spectacular. We were not brilliant. We progressed slowly, inexorably, walking up the hill one tiny little step at a time. And that's how we all got things done. And that's what I did too. One of my heroes, Richard Feynman, said, I don't care about brilliance. If you want to learn quantum mechanics, you have to study, you have to work, you have to think, you have to work, you have to study, you have to think. And then one day you understand quantum mechanics. And That's the way I've always felt too. So work a little step at a time. That's what we all do in my family. So, okay, there are rocks in the road sometimes, and you just step around them. I suspect that the most important part of my career, all of the things that I have done, has been playing with my imagination. My imagination is like an alter ego. So it's not hard to access your imagination. And I did it, different times, different places. But by and large, I ran every day, almost every day. And, first few minutes, you get your breathing down, then the day falls away, the immediate concerns. And you start to, the recesses of your mind start to open up. Now, I still had situational awareness. I didn't want to run into a school bus, but things start coming up, and the imagination was just basically fun. It had conversations with me. I know that sounds weird, sounds schizophrenic, but it would say, like, what is this flow dynamics thing? You don't actually know what it is. What are you going to do about that? So I had a lot of fun with that. And I, to the young guys and gals coming up today, you have to get in touch with your imagination, because it's rich. It's, and above all, it's fun. So, no, I never got to run down the alleyway with a lantern above my head yelling "Eureka!" It was all just gentle, small steps, and trusting my imagination.
Well, that's interesting, and thanks for sharing that. I think it's a good message for certainly our younger listeners, but. You're giving me an opportunity to tap into something. If we could go back in time a bit, because you've certainly written extensively about your childhood in your memoir, An American Boyhood, I couldn't help but notice several themes that were running through the book that I think certainly were possibilities of influencing your career as a physician. You write a lot about growing up with the freedom to live, explore, have adventures. But you also knew that with freedom came the responsibility for your actions. Can you elaborate on this and how this childhood foundation might have influenced your medical career beyond what you've just shared?
Well, I think my childhood is the essence of my medical career. Yeah, we had, my sisters and I had square miles of hills and hollows to play in, but with that freedom, there was a little risk. Sometimes you'd fall down the hill into the creek and limp home crying. And my grandmother, who knew everything, would dry the tears, bandage the cuts, hug, stop crying. But then she'd point down to the Band-Aid and say, "You made your bed, now lie in it." That's the way to teach kid responsibility. So in my practice, be nice to blame the nurse. It'd be nice to say that the fellow did something bad. Or what I often hear, this was the inevitable progression of a fatal illness. You can't do that. You got to look in the mirror. So yeah, that came mostly from my grandmother.
Yeah. And in your book, you also talk about the pride that you had in your family roots in Appalachian Hills in Western Pennsylvania. I've been there. I've been actually to West Virginia in that particular part of the world, and really helping some of the those that are less fortunate there. So there's certainly a very rural area. And back in those times when you were growing up, the steel mills and rail yards, they were critical, right, to the economy and to those particular areas. And you reference in your book the impression that you had of those steel workers, even men who worked on the Empire State Building. Of course, these are American heroes that no one will ever know their names. You benefited from them. You also got a rare scholarship to the University of Pittsburgh for college and medical school, eventually leaving your hometown. But I wonder about how these themes of pride and humility, country focus informed your work. Did it?
Oh my, yes. First, your comment about leaving your hometown, John. I'm a Appalachian redneck hillbilly at heart. That's never going to change. I've never left those hills. So, working in the mills was a really kind of life-changing experience. You left the hills and hollows. You went up north to the big city, McKeesport, and then another 15 miles up to the big city, Pittsburgh, to get educated. But in the mills, the mills were, well, frankly, dirty, dangerous. It was, but impressive at the same time. The image of a furnace, like a big bathtub, big as a house, turning on its side, pouring 100 tons of white hot steel into a ladle. Sparks everywhere, smoke everywhere. I mean, that stays with you, and it's like, it's not personal. It's like what we can do. What you want? 50 tank turrets? No problem. You want 47 miles of Boston, Baltimore and Ohio mainline rail? No problem. You want a pipe that'll stick together all the way a mile down into the Permian Basin? No problem. And we could do it. But that was like my country. And I know it's not fashionable to talk about my country today, but it's that same kind of thing, that feeling about us, the big us, that made me one day take an oath and get myself into the Marines. So as far as individual, no, that's all family. That's family.
Great. And you're certainly beyond all of that as you've evolved in your career. You're certainly known as a neuroradiologist, but you're also known as an innovator for sure, and who's developed, and I will certainly not capture it all, but developed devices such as flow-directed silicon catheters, calibrated leak balloon catheter, guide wires, and we're going to talk about liquid embolics and particles in a minute. But in 1999, I'll just reference this. Dr. Strother wrote in AJNR that an experience you had at the University of Oregon when a 12-year-old child died after the surgical removal of a brain AVM seemed to have ignited your innovative mindset. But I need to reference your childhood again, because you've also explained that watching the seamless steel tubing being created at the mill in your town was magnificent and the engineers were godlike. So drawing on that childhood, which I know we're diving deep into, and then we will move on. I think it's fascinating and I think it's worth sharing. When you watch those engineers in the mills and then your own experience in Oregon, I wonder if a seed was planted at that early age to be an innovator, whether you knew it or not. And the fact that you're able to merge that mindset and bring innovation to address patients' needs as a physician. Can you reflect on this a bit for us?
Well, a few things. First, Charlie Strother wrote a really flattering article about me, and I have to thank him for that. It was wonderful. I said working in the mill made me feel I could do anything, but we could do anything. The innovation came again from almost all from my dad. Hey, Dad, the lawnmower's broke. What were you doing when you broke it? So there's responsibility there. Nothing. Fix it. I don't know how. figure it out. And it was that always figure it out. And then, you know, an hour later, he would come and help me make it work. But it was always up to me. And the innovation part, I think I have to credit my dad for. It, and it carries over perfectly into the practice of medicine.
Yeah, for sure. I don't think, speaking of innovation, I'll talk about two items that I want to highlight a bit that are very connected to what I do as well. So I have a keen interest. I don't know that everybody knows about your very early involvement in the development of cyanoacrylates for therapeutic embolization. Now, if they've listened to any of our other podcasts that we've recorded so far, they will know that, because every other key opinion leader in our space credits you for educating them on the utilization of liquid embolic. But for our listeners today, can you talk about your role in that innovation, who you worked with, and how that idea came about?
Well, yeah, that's a good story because it involves a lot of people. It was team effort. And I have to tell you, all of my work is chemistry based, whether it's silicone tubing, PVA foam, and cyanoacrylates were the most fascinating. So the story starts with an intern at the University of Oregon, who got tired of getting up at night starting IVs. So what he did was he got a little bit of Dow Corning silicone tubing, put it in a syringe, squirted it into a vein. How he lost it, didn't lose it, I don't know. Hmm. Squirted it into a vein, and it lasted 4 or 5 days. So our chairman, Charles Daughter, figured he could use it in an artery. I played around with it, and I, you know, you couldn't see it. So finally, I located a company in Japan that would make a tantalum impregnated silicone tubing for me. They made me buy a mile. I still have some of the in the back room here. And that was what got us started. And I put a little silicone balloon on it. So that's the access part. I mean, Serbenenko had published his paper, so we were all in a rush to get out into the NIDAS. A friend of mine from my residency, neurosurgeon Paul Zanetti, had been given a grant by the Ethicon, the suture company, to develop cyanoacrylate as a way to join tiny blood vessels. Well, it didn't work because it was rock solid when it polymerized. So the advantage of cyanoacrylate is that it turns essentially instantly from a liquid to a solid when it touches blood or blood vessel wall. And that's its disadvantage at the same time. But as you mentioned, this little girl came in, and I worked with wonderful neurosurgeons up there, Harold Paxton and Tony Gallo. We got together, and the next patient came in. We lost that first patient. Next patient came in with a thalamic AVM. It had bled again, been operated upon. There was nothing that they could do. And quotes, "You think you're so smart with catheters, fix it." So it was like my dad again. Paul Zanetti had sent me some of his bucrylate. It was a 4-carbon moiety. And it was difficult to use, but Bill Bank and I squirted a catheter in, and I figured that the increased flow to an AVM would carry it up there. And it did. It took us like 3 seconds to get into this thalamic AVM. And we pushed a little bit of cyanoacrylate in blindly, jerked the catheter out, and thought that we were failures because we couldn't see anything. Mm-hmm. And the lady woke up the next day. So Pax and Tony and I thought, maybe there's something here. The next step was for my next fellow, Larry Cromwell, and I. We worked a whole summer trying to figure out how to slow the polymerization time, to make it controllable, and to make it radio opaque. So we did that. And the next patient came in, a 19-year-old student from University of Oregon, And he had a big occipital AVM, and we basically filled the whole nidus. We thought that was wonderful. And that is the background. That material you still have. It's TrueFill. You use a different oil for opacity now, but it's essentially the same thing. It's a four carbon moiety.
It's amazing how far we've come from those days as to what we're doing and treating patients. And I'm privileged to be talking to you about it because I think if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be here today. And there's a lot of really sick patients that have certainly been helped with liquid embolics. Let's dive a little bit into failure. And I know that there have been some amazing groundbreaking technologies, but as we talk about, and you mentioned before, rocks in the road or barriers, and I'll put it in quotes, sometimes there is failure. What can you share with us about your philosophy towards failure? And I know you and I chatted a little bit about this over lunch, but I'm also interested in how you persevered. Difficult procedures, patients are hurt. How did you keep going when things were difficult early on?
Patients aren't, quotes, hurt. We hurt them. And that's the first thing. When somebody starts out in internal medicine or radiology or pathology or something like that, and they put hands on a patient and they damage them, euphemism, complication, right? Okay. It is awful. And we handle it poorly. We tend to go back to the office in the afternoon, stare at the wall, and think the world has ended. Well, the first time I, honest to God, really killed a patient, just trying to get them better, didn't matter, they're dead. I was going to give up the field. And Harold Paxton, chief neurosurgery, sat me down and he said, "Look at the big picture. It's going to happen. You're inventing new things, get over it." It was still depressing, but that's
Having
what
that
got me
support,
going.
yeah, that support was there to help you, I guess, shake you out of it, so to speak. So, would you say that he was one of the, you mentioned his name now a few times, one of the key mentors for you early on? Was he really one of those driving forces?
No, he wasn't a mentor. He was like a partner. We
Okay.
did things together. I mean, I did have mentors, but he was a supportive partner. And you will find in the history of this field that having the supportive partner in the neurosurgery department is what let the field go forward. I mean, it was Charles Wilson in UC San Francisco, Paxton in Oregon. Now, if you went 120 miles north to Seattle, the neurosurgeons were totally threatened. And so they were 15 years behind when the field really got going.
That was the dynamic at the time. Okay. So, in addition to your career as a physician, and this is something you mentioned before, you served in the Marine Corps. Thank you for your service. I'd like to talk about fear and pressure, because you've worked in high-stakes situations as a physician, where these we talked about this, the split-second decisions can determine life or death outcomes. How did you approach or maybe harness fear, pressure, and emotion in those situations? And did you draw on the military experience in these high-stake moments? Were they connected?
Absolutely, absolutely. And let me do the military thing first. So I come out of medical school, come out of internship, sleep deprived, but I'm taught in the medical school that you gotta be brilliant. The military aviation's not that way. They say, you know what, we're human, and whenever there's an emergency, we don't think very well. So we are going to design a system to reduce risk in high stress environments. When it doesn't work, we have this saying, he had a helmet fire. So we fly with a flight helmet, And what happens in between your ears is you stop thinking. So they figured out a way to make you continue to function well in high stakes situation. So I use that all the time. I try to teach to my fellows too. I've written about makes the difference. Now, having said that, I think I was born without a strong adrenal axis because I've never, even in pretty dire circum personal dire circumstances, I've not felt fear. And the only stress that I've felt, not during a case, but dealing with administrators.
Definitely a difficult group of individuals at times to manage, for sure. Even though you're dealing with a life and death situation with a patient on the table, there's maybe that's because you have a little less control over that. I wonder.
Just I'm joking just a little bit.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break from this conversation to hear from our sponsor, Resonetics.
So, Andy, I want to talk about the design and manufacturing challenges that have been associated with nitinol. But first, can you help us understand why companies use nitinol in these extremity applications?
So 99% of the medical device applications use the unique property of nitinol called superelasticity. So what this is it allows you to achieve really high strains over with constant force. So it's different than a conventional elastic plastic material where those strains are much lower and actually not recoverable. So for a suture passing application, for example, you know, you want to follow a tortuous path, but you also want that device to spring back to its original shape afterward, right? For an implant, like a bone staple, you want to apply constant compression on the joint to allow it to heal faster, right? For bones to heal, they actually need compression. So that superelastic property allows us to insert that bone staple in by straining it and apply that constant force on that joint we're trying to fuse.
So let's now shift into the unique design and manufacturing challenges that are associated with nitinol devices. Can you help us understand that?
Number one is just understanding the superelastic properties, right? And how to achieve them, right? To get that performance in the device that you need. You know, comes along with that is heat treatments, right? To get those unique properties, you really need to understand the metallurgy and that link to the performance. Surface finishing is also very important. You need these devices to be biocompatible, right? So we've actually developed a lot of standard process flows over the years, and they've been optimized and proven again and again in order to help our customers get the ideal performance in their device. So we really are the leaders in the nitinol industry, and we really want to, our goal is really to help our customers get their next generation nitinol devices to the market faster.
Well, great, Andy. Thank you so much for spending your time with us on the podcast, and we wish you the very best.
Well, thank you, Resonetics, for sponsoring this episode. Again, for more information about Resonetics, go to resonetics.com.
So let's stay on the military for a moment, because I know that you experienced a dramatic event while you were flying. People might not know that you were in a plane crash, if I could describe it as such, and you ejected seconds before the plane hit the ground. And amazingly, you're here to talk about this today. But you also sustained some lifelong injuries to your hand, something that may seem insurmountable for a surgeon. But as one of your colleagues explained to me, for Chuck Kerber, and I'm quoting, surgery isn't just about his hands, it's about his heart and his mind. Can you share your thoughts on the accident and how your injuries affected your approach to surgery?
Did one of my fellows actually say that?
Yes.
That was wonderful. I have to thank whoever said that. So another thanks goes to Sir James Martin for inventing ejection seats. And, you know, I still love to fly in jets. I like to be up at 40,000 feet. And I flew all the time in the military. I was a flight surgeon. So one of my patients, a pilot, said, I'm going up to Norfolk. Want to come along? So I get kitted up, get in the back seat. And it's just like our field. First, he made a judgment error. Then he made a technical error. You can see where this is going. Mm-hmm. Then he made mm-hmm. another judgment error. And he dropped the airplane, just dropped it right out of the sky. So as soon as I saw that, I reached up and pulled the curtain down that fired the seat. And all of a sudden, I'm another 100 feet up in the air. And we were about 80 feet above the ground at the time. So parachute comes out perfectly, but just like in the movies. I mean, it looks just like what you see in the movies. This big fireball comes. And I'm right above it. And it melts my parachute. So I'm in there, my emergency oxygen works and my helmet stays on, and I wake up and I get up and I run out. And consequently, I go to Bethesda. I get air evacuated to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and I get put in the E ward. Well, in military medicine, there are three categories. One, he doesn't need anything right now. He can wait. This guy needs to go in the operating room right now, or that guy's going to make it. Not going to make it. We'll put him on the E ward, the expectant ward. So that's where I went. Mm. And you know, we didn't have intensive care units back in the day. It was a big ward, a lot of beds, and a lot of us there. Every once in a while, we got to know each other at night. You know, every once in a while, one of us would die. So yeah. I had 35% burns, and the thing that was obvious was my hands. So, my survival there, and in a military hospital, you can decide whether you're going to live or die. And people decide whether they can earn a living, in which case they survive. And if they don't think so, they don't necessarily choose to survive. So the thing that got me through was I had absolute support from my wife Claire every day. It was amazing. So I had a family to support. So I went through all of the rehab, all the surgeries, probably went to the operating room 30 times. Mm. And then I'm puzzled. I mean, what do you notice first on a surgeon? You notice the hands. So at least I do. And I didn't know what to do. So I didn't do anything. And I still didn't know what to do. And I still didn't do anything. And so all of a sudden, 50 years goes by and I still don't know what to do. And mm-hmm. not a single, I mean, how many patients do you take care of in 40, 50 years then? 15, 20,000, not a single person has ever asked me about this. And, you know, they work. So upward and onward.
There you go. Wow. Thank you for sharing that with us and with the podcast audience. I have one more topic on your military service. It's related to a comment you made before about just basically your training. You mentioned to me when we were chatting at lunch, NATOPS, which was ultimately developed to improve combat readiness. And you felt that this was something that certainly could be applied in our space, in our neurovascular world in particular, probably broader medicine. Can you share a little of your perspective on that?
Yeah. Smart people figured in the late 50s that they were running out of airplanes because pilots were careless. They didn't seem to care about the pilots dying, but they were running literally out of airplanes. So they studied it and they came up with a thing they called Naval Aviation Training and Operations, NATOPS. And it's perfectly applicable to what we do. So step number one, you have a diagnosis, right? You have intelligence in the military, and then you create a mission. In our field, it was like there is an aneurysm. I intend to hack the aneurysm. And then you make a plan. All right, so part A, mission. Part B, plan. And being compulsive as I am, there's always a plan B in case that doesn't work. And the truth is, pathologically compulsive, I always had an absolute go-to-hell emergency plan. If there were an earthquake, I wanted to know something to do. So now you've got a plan. Next thing is communicate. You got to communicate your plan to your crew, not just your fellow, the rest mm-hmm. of the rest of the crew. So the communication. And the next thing is you followed the plan. And I had a 14-point checklist. I went right down before I even touched a patient. And then you did the plan. You flew the flight. You did the case. And then what we don't do, but what they did afterwards, the flight, is get together and discuss the flight. Now, in the movies, you think Tom Cruise goes out and flies a flight all alone. No, you always fly with another person, sometimes two, sometimes 16. So you go back to some quiet place afterwards, and you do what's called a debrief, and you, most junior guy starts out, and rank is not there. It says, you almost killed me when you did so-and-so. So we don't do that. We get on to the next case. Mm-hmm. And so we lose out on the learning that is possible before you forget, before you use the denial that is inevitable with our less than sterling moves during the case. So that's NATOPS. I've written that's about great. It. I think one person read the editorial, and that's one of my great failures in medicine as a teacher, that I have not been able to bring that into our practice.
Well, maybe those listening to this podcast might gain some interest. So stay tuned. Maybe you'll get someone pinging you about NATOPS and learning more. Let's keep our fingers crossed. But you know, you lead me to it down a path, because it started me thinking about another topic that I have for you when you mentioned the debrief, the post-procedure discussion. And you're right, physicians are very busy, schedules tend to rush to the next case. You've always been a fixture at a meeting that I've attended for many years that we used to call the Jackson Hole Complications Meeting, which is now the Cerebrovascular Complications Conference in Jackson Hole. You were a fixture of this, and probably where I first met you, and where I think many of us learned from you and listened to you as a senior person in the room even back then. Can you talk about how you got involved in that meeting and some key takeaways during your career? And I ask that because I think one of the areas that clinicians learn the most from, including industry as well, is the failures, failure analysis. And that obviously was important to you to participate in that. Maybe just talk about that for a bit, if you don't mind.
You're right. That is where we met. So I don't get any credit for any of this, but I went to Paris. I think it was a visiting professor or something like that. And there was an Algerian guy who was working in Paris, René Gingin, D-J-I-N, René Gingin. And he, back in the day, we were figuring out new things every week, and that's what we wanted to talk about. That's what we wanted to write about. But René stood up in front of all of us and showed his adverse events. And I want to tell you, they were horrible. I mean, you just got depressed looking at them, but he was still trying. And I realized that I learned more in that hour than I'd learned in the previous 5 years. So I decided I'm going to have a meeting like that too. So my fellows and I met here, and the price of admission was your worst complication that year. So about the second day, I would pass out tranquilizers and mood elevators. It was so bad, but we learned an incredible amount. And then it got superseded by the Jackson meeting because it was better. There were more people. And what Nick Hopkins got it really organized. What really made it good was that he invited industry. And I mean, here's our partners. They don't know what troubles we're having. And all of a sudden, they're in a room where we're opening the kimono and showing the worst things that we could have done. And they're sitting back there saying, yeah, I can fix that. That's wonderful that he did that. So I think Nick gets the credit for really spreading the idea that you can't get into the meeting unless you show your worst complication.
Yeah, that's great. Great insight there. And I'm going to follow up on what you hinted at a minute ago when you brought your fellows together. First, I'm going to highlight a couple of things and maybe a little funny story for me. Many of the individuals that ultimately came through your training, through your mentorship, whether it was Bill Bank or beyond, that used to collect at an annual meeting somewhere, maybe it was at the time ASITN, SNIS Now, ASNR, and I would have a dinner scheduled with, say, Rob Tarr, Jeff Sunshine, and others, and we'd be ready to have a meeting, and all of a sudden they would call and say, I'm sorry, I have to cancel, which is always disappointing to me. But it was always because they had to attend something that was mysterious to me, which was the Kerber Society meeting. So can you talk about that and the purpose that it served? I think I know the answer because I've already pinged you about this one, but I think it's important because, again, as we develop as a field, learning from each other is important, but sharing that amongst each other, I think this is a great example of how one can pull together a group of experts and talk about the things that they've learned. Talk about the Kerber Society, please.
Oh, I didn't call it that.
Okay.
My fellows did. And I've already mentioned it. We got together. The price of admission was your worst complication during the prior 6 months, year, whatever. And we really learned from each other because there was no ego at the time. You were not allowed to say the personal pronoun. I made this technical error, then I followed that up with this judgment error, then I made another technical error, and look what happened. So it was no ego. And the critical thing about these meetings and what we enforced at Nick's meetings was no personal attack. You could criticize the basic premise, you could criticize the observation, but you could never, ever criticize the person.
That's great, because that keeps an open dialogue. We have a photo here that one of your fellows shared with us. It's an image of a right brain lapel pin and a hook. What can you tell us about these pins?
Well, the hook is easy, straightforward. If you have landed on an aircraft carrier, you get to wear the hook pin. The brain pin is a little different. That's medical. That's totally medical. And it comes from back in the day, I was invited to be a visiting professor at an institution whose name I will carry to my grave for graduation of a fellow. So I give a talk. He gives a talk. It's we're having a good time. And then the chief brings in this large collage, images of every one of his adverse events. I mean, here's a kid who's worked for him for 2 years, day and night, and all he can give him is a reminder of his mistakes. And I thought, it destroyed the kid's evening. It was terrible. And I thought, that's not right. So I wanted to make something that had intrinsic value, so it's going to be 18 karat gold, and I wanted to have it of emotional value. Well, we work in the right brain mostly. That's what we use with all of these complicated real-time judgments. And so I carved a right brain in wax and had it cast in gold, and I gave that to my fellows, and I think that they felt pretty good about it. Oh, there was one of them, one good story. Another military guy, he was on active duty at the time, Rich Berger. Mm-hmm. I said, you want this as a blood pin, don't you? Does everybody know what blood pins are? When you finish something difficult in the military, they put your badge on and they put it through the skin of your chest. So you're supposed to not scream. So I said, I wouldn't have it any other way. So I pounded it on his chest. And that was his blood pin.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. So you've referenced your fellows multiple times. Let's talk a little bit about mentorship, if we can. But before we do that, I also want to, talk about the reference that you, the impact, I should say, that you had on your peers. There was a time when I was speaking with Fernando Venuela when he talked about visiting you. I believe it was in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Lots of physicians have visited you there to learn fellowship, extended time, shorter times, to learn the techniques that you were pioneering at the time. Can you talk a little bit about that time in your career and what it was like to have what I would consider today some of the other pioneers in the space learning from you?
I'd argue with the idea that they, quotes, learned from me. I mean, like, Fernando came. Fernando was really good. And yeah, he wanted to learn to use cyanoacrylates. So he did that very quickly. And truth is, I learned probably more from him than he did from me. And that happened all around. We visited each other and we learned from each other, but I don't see it as I taught him. I mean, we just kind of shared things. It was very open back then.
Yeah. They say it a little differently, but that's okay. You're humble.
No, I'm not humble.
Your mentees, and we spoke to a few of them, your fellows, they were very open that you gave them permission to be creative. And I can tell by our conversation so far that was your style. You allowed them to be challenged, and you were always there, though, to support them. And you mentioned this is similarly how your grandparents and the role that they played in your life. Can you share a bit about how you approach mentorship during your career, that is, and what you hoped that your students would gain from building those relationships? Because I know also you've built personal relationships with your fellows even to today.
Yeah. So my rule was to think about everything in my training and do exactly the opposite. It was really that simple. The first time I had good training, personally good training, was Marine Air. The mission was clear. There was no scut work. There was plenty of rest. And everything that was done to further you along the road to success. So I really liked teaching, it turned out. I learned that the way to get people to get the mission done was to keep pushing them to the point where they got almost stuck, but never to the point of being stuck, because then they regressed. Same in flying, same thing. So you're standing there, they're doing the case, you're just watching their eyes. And when it comes to a certain point, you just say, okay, I'll do this part now. I need a little practice. And that's the way it worked. Mm-hmm. I mean, but they were all good. Bill Bank I like to pull his chain a little bit. When he'd get to that point, I'd say, here, let me show you. Look how easy this is. So
that's an actual quote from Dr. Bank that you said to us. Look at how easy this is. Oh, boy. That stuck with him, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. I learned a lot from him, too.
Let's talk about fellows. How did you go about selecting and finding your fellows?
Finding fellows?
Yeah.
Pure science. It's absolute science.
Yeah.
Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory first, and a piece of chalk to carve to test for eye hand skills, interview with a psychiatrist, interview
Perfect.
With me. You don't believe
Perfect.
That, do you?
No, not a bit. It's
No.
a gut thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I'll tell you well, my own to begin with. I was in private practice up in a little town north of San Francisco, and interested in neuro, so I would drive into San Fran to go to Hans Newton's conference, and in a few weeks it became obvious that they were so far ahead of the rest of the country that I wanted to do that. Now, I'm sure UCLA thought they were farther ahead, but the two centers certainly were the leaders. So I went to Hans and I said, I want to be your fellow. And he laughed at me. He said, I'm filled for 4 years. Well, okay, I was going to go back to private practice for 4 years. But I said, just take my name down and who knows? So this was January. 15 June, he calls me. He said, my fellow just backed out. Can you be here July 1st? That's how I got picked to be
Wow.
a fellow. So Bill Bank, we've talked about Bill Bank. He's first fellow. I used to have a conference every week called Neuroenology, where we would discuss one or two cases, and we would sample Oregon-based wines. And he decided he wanted to come to that. He was in private practice, or residency. And so a day came, he saw an airplane model, and he said, fly? And yeah, we had that in common. He was a flight surgeon too. So he said, I want to be a fellow. Okay, that was it. Larry Cromwell, second fellow, did something to Charles' daughter, who was somewhat excitable. And we had this staff meeting, and Charles was walking around the room, pounding on the table. Some profanity was involved, and he's fired. He's out of here. Get him out. I don't want to see him ever again. And so I said, oh, Charles, I wish you would have told me that 2 weeks ago, because I've promised him my fellowship slot for this year. And you can't expect me to go back on my word. So he fumed. And then immediately afterwards, I grabbed Cromwell and took him off into a dark place and said, you're going to be my fellow. He said, no, I'm not. But he was my fellow, so he didn't get fired. It was the same with Joe Horton. Joe Horton was fired. And I said to Arthur, I actually had to drag Joe Horton physically, grab his arm and take him into the angio suite. And I said, you're my fellow next year. That worked out.
It's an interesting technique. You've developed a few techniques in your career.
Yeah.
I'm going to shift a little bit. And we talked about complications, but the one thing that we didn't talk about was interacting with patients and their families. And, I know you've seen patients and families on what probably is the worst day of their lives, or amongst the worst days. But we've also heard many people reference about you, the humanity and the calmness that you showed to your patients and their families. And this was very evident in those that we spoke to. Can you remember those difficult times, what was going through your mind at that moment as you were trying to reassure the family? And this is more about a high risk procedure where you know going into it that you're not sure ultimately what that outcome may be due to potential risks. How did you manage that in your mind, and how did you communicate confidence to those families?
And to my fellows.
And to your fellows.
It goes back to my third year in medical school. I was a prisoner of the Halsted Osler method of training. We've talked about that. And And then in my junior year, I got to spend 3 months with a private pediatrician, Bernie Michaels. And Bernie Michaels took me from being an automaton spewing back facts, and he taught me to be a doctor, real doctor. So our patients are special because they come to us with a diagnosis almost always. And the diagnosis of something awful. I cannot tell you how many times people say, I have a bomb in my head. So their stress level is off the charts. So what do they want? They want to be reassured. They want to think that you, doc, are competent. And that comes across, I think, two things. One, you need to appear confident in control. You have to have a plan. You have to communicate the plan. And you have to have this difficult to define thing called compassion. And compassion is not like, I feel your pain. It's not that. It's not pity, certainly not looking down. It's not empathy. It's not anything. It's a thing that you have to learn to communicate. That shows that you know what they feel, and you got to fix it best as you can. So that's what I did. Now, training the fellows, you know, they watch you. The hardest thing for a fellow going into a small examining room like that with all attention is to learn to keep your mouth shut. They said, keep your mouth shut, introduce yourself, and a patient will tell you in 90 seconds everything important about themselves, and then you can proceed. So that's how I did it.
It's great. You mentioned the quote, sorry I made it look so easy, when it came to Bill Bank. Is there more to tell about that?
No. Okay. I used to always put the needle into Bill. Bill was really good. He had great eye-hand skills, and he worked hard. So every once in a while, to bring him back down to earth, I would say, well, that's three times. And that was my rule. You try three times, and then I would do it. But okay, I do it. But then I would turn and look up to him. He was about that tall.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would say, I'm sorry I made that look so easy. Get back.
He gave you a lot of credit for having unbelievable skills for catheters. So I think he was learning from you at that time. So while you needled him a bit, it certainly made a lasting impression on him, which I'm sure he's conveyed to his own fellows.
I think so. I hope so.
Chuck, I know you have a major history in innovation, but part of that is the relationships that you've had with industry, and you touched on it before. Can you just talk a little bit more about the importance of the relationship between industry and clinicians, especially now, you know, in this current environment is high scrutiny, wanting to make sure that that it's all properly evaluated, and becoming increasingly difficult in this current time. So talk about why the importance of that for you, if you could.
You've touched on my pet peeve. Our industry doesn't get, as Rodney Dangerfield say, they don't get no respect. And it has always bothered me. You think about the tools that we have today. We didn't make those tools. That's for certain. So again, we go back to Nick Hopkins, getting everybody involved. I've always been involved with every support member of our team. That's you, absolutely. So that started back when I was a fellow at San Fran. I would say, I mean, we didn't have anything back then. I would say to Ross Jennings, who was the Coke representative, I said, this doesn't work. Can you make me a so-and-so? Next week on his rounds, he would bring it in. So that's how I got started being interested in developing relationships with our friends. I mean, the engineers have a hard time. You know, how do you figure out what you really need? So when I'm king of the world, I'm going to make sure that the people who invent the devices get put on our scientific papers, because they deserve to be there, and they deserve a little bit more recognition than they get right now.
That's great to hear. You were the fourth president of the SNIS. Can you talk about a little bit about that and what holding that position meant to you and how that all came about?
It was awful. It was honest to God awful. First, I don't have executive skills. Second, we were in incredible debt. I mean, we were so far in the red. And so without money up front, you can't put on a meeting. And without a meeting, you can't get in the black. I mean, it's catch 22. So I'd wake up every morning and I'd think, is this the day I'm going to have to sign the articles of bankruptcy every single day? And it was terrible. Anyhow, the nurse surgeons had a meeting, and they said, yeah, you can have a joint meeting with us. Good idea. And it'll cost you N dollars, some astronomical amount of money. And I said, we only have red money. We're in the hole. And they thought about it and thought about it. And they came back to us and they said, you know what? We're going to be kind and charitable to you. You can be part of our meeting. And so we went in the black, being in partnership with the brain surgeons. And the year ended. I was never so happy to give up a gavel in my entire life.
That's an interesting story. I'm trying to think of how many presidents we've had since then, but I think this society is doing fairly well now, so it's come a long way.
Oh, did you see the leadership now? I mean, go yes. to the meeting?
Yes.
I mean, my God, it's incredible. Where did yeah. these people come from?
It's expanding quite rapidly, and lots yeah. of diversity as well, and yeah. specialties, you name it. It's really an amazing evolution of the society, and the training that's taking place is also significant. And we've got great societies all around on the globe, which is very, very gratifying for me. And I work very closely with all of the societies. Chuck, you've seen a lot in your career. It's a long career. Has anything surprised you within our field and how it developed?
No, not at all. I thought it was inevitable.
And now I'll touch on the future. The field has grown and evolved into a new medical frontier, right? We're expanding the horizons. There are adjacencies everywhere. What do you think is the next major area that we need to address or solve?
John, I can predict anything except for the future. And my history of trying to project the future is so abysmal that I can't even begin to touch that. I have no idea.
Okay.
I know it's going to be a big deal.
Fair enough. And I think that's a reasonable answer. In your book, you reference the young physicians in our industry as the new greatest generation. You have a lot of hope for their passion, professionalism, their commitment to the field. So in addition to their hard work and their focus on their patients, what advice do you have for those physicians entering our space today?
Well, you touch on one thing first. For example, those two kids you introduced, Jesus. When you're my age, you tend to call a 30-year-old doctor a kid. Those two men, young men, that you introduced me to last week, I mean, they were awesome. I don't think that I could get an entry into this group today if I tried. Advice to them? It's about imagination. Get your face out of the screen, because if your face is in the phone, your imagination is never going to get out of the recesses of your mind. And that's where all the fun of our profession is, in your imagination.
That's great advice. And what can you tell me about your days now, or actually tell our audience, because you already shared with me that you're spending time being more creative, painting, sculpting. What are you doing, and what draws you to this creativity today?
Well, again, that started back in the family. Even, you know, back in the day, when I was a little boy, I liked the fine arts, and I just never had an opportunity. Time was too short when you're doing clinical medicine, and now I have time to go back and put paint on canvas, and especially to make three-dimensional stuff, sculptures, because the eye-hand skills, especially the eye skills, are exactly the same as what we use maneuvering in the brain and making catheters work. Exactly the same.
Wow, that's amazing. So I want to say thank you for participating in this podcast. And before we conclude, I do have a lightning round of questions for you. That will be one word answers. So whatever pops into your mind is what we would like to take away. Are you ready?
Shoot.
If you could invite any three historical or public figures, dead or alive, to a dinner party, who would they be?
Ben Franklin. I'd like to have dinner with Marie Curie and her husband. But the guest of honor would be Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach. I mean, he was the greatest.
Excellent. Thank you. If you had one book to read for the rest of your life, what would it be?
I cannot conceive of that life. I cannot conceive of having only one book.
The tough question, I know. And with your creativity, are you more creative in the morning or the afternoon?
I don't think time of day matters. I think the ability to sit down and let go and look at the horizon is the creative time. And it might be 10 o'clock at night. And when you're retired and you have enough rest, it might be 2 o'clock in the morning, but usually it isn't.
Well stated. What is one talent you wish you had that you don't?
Can't sing. Give anything to be able to sing.
Now, this is a tough one because you have a couple of locations, but Steelers or Chargers?
So the first thing, it's not Steelers. Back in Pittsburgh, it's Stillers. How about Stillers? Them? Stillers.
Stillers or Chargers?
Could not care less. I'm probably only male in all of America that could care less about a bunch of guys running up and down a field chasing a ball. So
what about baseball?
Same thing. Don't care. It's just not important. I do follow Olympic gymnastics because I was a gymnast, but you're all alone out there when you're a gymnast. You can't blame anybody for your screw-ups. No, I don't care. I don't care about sports.
I'm going to hold that gymnast for the next podcast, by the way, because I have a few more questions that we didn't dive into. Last question. If you had not gone into medicine, what would your career have been?
It is almost impossible for me to conceive of doing anything else. But if I had something else, I would want to lead my friends I would like to conduct the San Diego Symphony.
Excellent. With that, we're going to conclude today, Chuck. On behalf of our whole community, I want to really thank you for your transparency, your openness, and sharing your history, your thoughts, your perspectives. We appreciate you, and thanks for being part of the Neuro Innovation Talks.
Thank you, and thank you for what you're doing. I appreciate it, John.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Neuro Innovation Talks podcast. Thanks, of course, to our friends at Johnson & Johnson MedTech Neurovascular. It's been great to work with them, in particular with John Murray, who's spearheaded this effort and really helped us tell some important neurovascular stories. If you don't want to miss a future episode of Neuro Innovation Talks or our other great Device Talks podcast, make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. We'll have future podcast episodes sent directly to you. You can also follow us on YouTube. We'll have our audio and video portions or versions up there. So lots of great ways to keep informed and to gain great medtech insights. Finally, make sure you share this podcast episode on LinkedIn and other social media channels. And when you do, connect with me, Tom Salemi, Editorial Director at Device Talks, and our great managing editor, Kayleen Brown. We'd love to be part of your future MedTech conversations. That's it, folks. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Neuro Innovation Talks podcast.